Okay, so today we're going to try to get through Zechariah chapter 13. Now, there's 14 chapters in Zechariah, so next week we will finish that. When I put these slides up on the website, I'll put the real slides up so you can kind of look at them if you want to. I've got probably more information there than I'll cover this morning. My memory's good, but not that good. And so we'll try to do that, and you'll be able to see them at least. And then next week we'll do that. We'll do a summary of the book of Zechariah next week as we finish. And then after that, I want to start something that I want to do for at least 2 weeks. I want to do a class on what I would call These Things We Believe, Baptist Faith and Message. And the reason I want to do that, first of all, I think it's all important that we all kind of understand what it is as a church we believe, what it is Baptists believe. We've got a lot of people in here that come from other backgrounds. You know, we've got people that are Methodist, we've Catholic, maybe different kind of Baptists than we are, Presbyterian, Lutheran. We've got a lot of different, and I've probably missed a few. We've got a lot of people here, and I just want to kind of reset where we are. The pastor did a sermon last week on baptism, which is a real important one. He does one of those every year. And baptism will be one of the things we cover as well. I won't cover it in the same level he did, but I'll cover what I think the Baptist side of it is and why it's important, plus all the other fundamental beliefs. Most of the beliefs are what you would call Orthodox Christian beliefs, and all of them are Orthodox Christian beliefs, but some of them are distinctively Baptist, and we'll talk about what they are and why they are that way and the scripture that backs them up. So hopefully, you know, when people come in here and they come in from another background, you will be able to have a conversation with them if they ever ask the question, why do you do it this way? Well, there's an answer to why we do it this way, and this is what it is. You know, many people, one of the sayings I really like was on a Moravian church when we lived in Boca Raton, Florida, and it said, unity in essentials, diversity in non-essentials. And the question then is, what is an essential and what is a non-essential? And we'll try to cover that as part of this thing. I won't do it in that specifically, but you'll understand what it is we think is essential and what our beliefs are on it. So I hope you'll come to that. I hope I may put together a little pamphlet when I'm done, although there's a lot of those that are floating around. I'll be using one by an old-time Baptist theologian named Herschel Hobbs. Many of you know Herschel Hobbs, know of him. I've got his book and several others that are out of print, but they're 50 years old, but they're great. You know, they're different than the new ones. And that's what we'll cover. Any questions about that? Any thoughts? Yeah.
So normally you do an update on what's going on
in Israel
and America.
Okay.
So last night.
So you want me to do that?
Bob and I really look forward to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
If I'm prepared to do that, then
please don't let us. No, I'm prepared to do that. We watched last night up through the time that the president spoke. As you know, many of you may, if you haven't read the news, you may not, but the White House Correspondents' Dinner was last night. This is the first one Trump has ever gone to as president, and it was packed, and people were all there in their tuxes and their beautiful gowns and all that kind of stuff, and it was all starting off well, and then a guy came in. Didn't get in the room, but he came up to the what they call the magnetic gates where they check everybody for weapons. And he raced through the gates, and of course they caught him. He shot a Secret Service agent in the chest, but the guy thankfully had on a bulletproof vest, and he's bruised and he's sore, but he's alive. And so, and of course they caught the guy. They didn't kill him, but you know, they found a rifle and a shotgun, a rifle and a handgun with ammunition. So nobody knows exactly what his plan was. It's interesting. He is a computer engineer. He is a teacher in Southern California, 31 years old, and for all intents and purposes looked like a brilliant person, fine, upstanding person. So I guess they'll figure out. You know, they're going through his house right now to find out what's there, you know, if anything is a clue. And I don't know whether he's talking, but I'm sure they're talking to him. But he's under arrest right now anyway, and he'll be charged with a number of things. Yeah, Martha.
Wonder he rode a train from California there. How did he get on a train and through all these other places with guns?
Well, you can bring a gun on most places if you pack it separately and it's unloaded. Just like an airplane, you can, like, if you're going to go hunt in Wyoming, you can pack a gun as long as it's broken down and the ammo is separated from it, and you put it in a secure case. So there's a way to do that. Now, how he did it, I don't know. He may, because the rifle had to be put together. I think it was broken down. He had to put it together. But
Guest in the hotel.
he was a guest in the hotel. So I don't know. We'll hear more about that later. It was interesting, though. Trump was pretty philosophical about it and said, "This is pretty much territory for the job," you know. And somebody asked him, I thought it was a pretty interesting question, "Why do you think they're targeting you?" And he said, "Well, look back in history at the presidents who've been shot. The presidents that did nothing didn't get shot. The presidents that did something, people didn't like and they went after them." And that's pretty accurate when you really look at it. I mean, all the way from, Lincoln to Kennedy, you look at them and it's kind of interesting. But the Secret Service and the local police all did what they were supposed to do last night. I'm surprised the guy made it as far as he did into the deal, but I'm sure that's going to change. But that's kind of what happened last night. Now, on Israel, Lebanon is still a problem. Hezbollah has not laid down their weapons, and they say they're going to, but then they fire five missiles, and of course, Israel takes them all out. And in Iran, there's still a blockade, and I think they've now ordered all these little, they call fast boats. As soon as they poke their nose out of the cave, they're going to sink them all. So I think that's kind of what the plan is now, and they're going to open the straits. They've got minesweepers in there, a lot of things. So I think that's still a little bit too early to know what's going to happen, but I don't think what's going to happen is going to take very long, because I think they're going full steam ahead at it. And then, of course, in the U.S., along with what happened last night, election starts, so that's going to be a interesting time. Looks like the Republicans may have a way to get the people paid and get the government opened again, although that's not really finalized yet anyway. So just watch this space. The next few days will be pretty interesting on a lot of respects, so just pay attention to that. Anything you want me to comment on that I can't think of right now? Okay. Well, let's get started with today. Last time we got through Zechariah 12, about through the first 8 verses. And let me read them to you just to get you square on where we are and where we're going to pick up today. So in Zechariah, the last 3 or 4 chapters don't deal with the present of Zechariah, they deal with the future. And the first couple of them dealt with the first coming of the Lord. The last 12, 13, and 14 deal with the second coming of the Lord. So we're all in the time now of the second coming of the Lord when we get to Zechariah 12. And as I mentioned last week, this is not a complete anthology of what's going to happen. But when you look at what he says, and you look at when it was written, 500 BC, and you look at where we are now, you can see stuff going on right now that was predicted 2,500 years ago. And you wonder about the accuracy of God's prophets. I would just say if they're not accurate, they're not God's prophets, because his word is truth, whether it's in the future, history just not played out yet, or whether it's actually past, and it's history in the past. So in chapter 12, let me just read this. It says, "The oracle of the word of the Lord concerning Israel, thus declares the Lord, who stretched out the heavens and founded the earth and formed the spirit of man within him." We talked last week about how this relates in very shorthand version of Genesis, where he lays out how the earth was formed and how man was formed, and puts breath in the man, spirit in the man. The word spirit in Hebrew is the word ruach, which is breath. So he talks about the spirit of the Lord, which is the breath of the Lord, ties very close with Genesis. He says, "Behold, I'm about to make Jerusalem a cup of staggering, a cup of Trembling is in a lot of translations. I'll explain that in a minute. To all the surrounding peoples, the siege of Jerusalem will also be against Judah. On that day, I'll make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will surely hurt themselves, and all the nations of the earth will gather against it. On that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with panic, its rider with madness. But for the sake of the house of Judah, I will keep my eyes open when I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Then the clans of Judah shall say to themselves, the inhabitants of Jerusalem have strength through the Lord of hosts, their God. Let me just kind of net this out in terms of where we are now. As I've said many times, Jerusalem is God's hour hand. Excuse me, Israel is the hour hand. Jerusalem is the minute hand. And the second hand is the Temple Mount when you look at God's prophecy. And what he's laying out here is the fact that all the people that surround Israel will come against Israel. They will hate Israel. And of course, that's really plain to us today. Even the ones that have a treaty with them, it's a pretty narrow treaty, because there's a lot of animosity in the various people groups in Egypt and in Jordan, and you know, even in Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, a lot of hate to Israel, for Jewish people in general. And he says, I will make Jerusalem a stumbling block, or a cup of trembling. In other words, it's going to be the thing that causes this. Everybody wants Jerusalem. They want the Temple Mount. They want it for their mosques. They want it for whatever reason. They want it just to get rid of the Jews. That's a cup of it's a cup of trembling, and it makes them shake for anticipation for it. And then he says he'll make Jerusalem a heavy stone. Anybody who tries to pick it up is going to get hurt. Well, all these people throughout time have tried to take Jerusalem, and they succeeded for a while. And now Israel's back in the land, and it's not so easy today to take Jerusalem. And everybody who tries it, Israel knocks down in a very strong way. I mean, we see that all since 1948. All that's history. And it says, I will strike. First of all the nations will come against it. And he uses the phrase on that day. And that phrase is used, I don't know, 10 or 15 times in these two chapters, 12 and 13. And I'll talk about, I have a real nice chart on what on that day means. And I'm just going to have to see if I can remember it. I think I can remember most of it. So on that day, he's talking about, and again, this is the second coming. So he's talking about a day in the future. And if you understand the word day in Hebrew, the word day is the word Yom. We have Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, Yom Teruah, Day of Trumpets. The Day of the Lord that we talk about, that's all through the Old Testament. Joel and other places talk about the Day of the Lord. Day is generally considered 24 hours, but not always. In Hebrew and in English, you know, we say we live in the days of grace. That doesn't mean there's just one day of grace. It means we live in the time of grace, an era of grace, an epoch of grace. Yom is the same way. So when he says the day of the Lord, he doesn't just mean a single day. He means a period of time. And I think that's important, because when you understand that this is the tribulation period, you understand that's a 7-year period, which is considered the day of the Lord, considered Jacob's trouble, considered the tribulation time, a lot of different names for that period of time. All of them are spoken about when the prophet says the day of the Lord. So he says, on that day, I will strike every horse with panic and his rider with madness. Now, we can look at this very literally, and we can say, so what's he going to do to the horses? But understand that some of this is symbolic. And while we can take that as literal as a horse, it doesn't necessarily mean that, because this was the way they got around. They rode horses. They didn't have Jeeps and Humvees and tanks and planes. But when you say you're going to strike a horse with blindness, what does it mean? If you struck a horse with blindness, what does it mean for the horse? He can't see where he's going. Well, think about automated things, mechanized things. If you strike them with blindness, what do you do? You take away their radar. You take away their ability to see over the horizon. You take away their ability to see where the enemy is. I'm not saying that's what this is, but I'm just saying, don't let your mind be narrowed down to a horse and a rider, because all of this kind of prophetic literature is symbolic. Some of it we take literally. Some of it is literal, but it's a metaphor for something else. I don't know what this is. My sense is it's a metaphor, although many people think in the time of when this occurs, a lot of the mechanized things will not work anymore, and many people will actually resort to horses, because that's the way Russians in particular still use horses for part of their mechanized cavalry. So I don't know what that means, but I just say keep an open mind to that. But all I would say is understand this is in the time, in this phase called the Day of the Lord. They said, the inhabitants of Jerusalem will have the strength through the Lord of hosts. Lord of hosts means the Lord of angel armies. We've talked about this. So what's happening in Israel right now? We talked about this too. Many of them are so happy they've got an armed forces that can fight, and they've got weapons and tools that are better than their enemies. But many of them are also coming to understand that the Lord is with them in this. And when they fire 3,000 missiles and only three get through and they hit empty territory, that's not just a success of technology. It's the fact that God is with them in this endeavor. We're just seeing Israel now begin to recognize that. It's really slow to come, because I think they're still blinded in many ways. But you're seeing in this a really kind of an early view of where we are today in the world. It says, on that day, I will make the clans of Judah. Clans is families or tribes. Think about that. Of Judah, like a blazing pot in the middle of wood, like a flaming torch among sheaves. They'll devour to the right and to the left all the surrounding peoples, while Jerusalem shall again be inhabited in its place in Jerusalem. Well, what does this mean? Think about a wood pile. Think about a hot fire placed in the middle of a dry wood pile. What's going to happen? It's going to burn. It's going to burn hot. And this says he's going to make the people of Jerusalem like this blazing pot. And it's amazing to me just to watch the IDF and the IAF and all the other Israeli forces go against vastly superior numbers of people. And guess what? One or two, if any, get hurt, and they kill thousands of others. And that's kind of an asymmetric battle. But what you're seeing here is a prophecy fulfilled, that Israel will have superhuman ability to do what they're doing because God will be with them. And they're beginning to see that. And then it says that Jerusalem will be left in its place. After all the dust settles, after all the battles run, after all the people trying to take Jerusalem, guess what? It's still there. And, you know, people go to bomb shelters, but as soon as the bomb clear goes, they go back to the grocery, they do whatever they were doing. They live a normal life, except when the sirens go off, they head to a bomb shelter until the sirens go off again, then they come out. They're living their lives, even in the midst of a difficult time. It says, and the Lord will give salvation to the tents of Judah first, the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem may not surpass that of Judah. This is interesting wording, but what it really means is I will provide this at the same time. So when it's just like it says, we will be raptured, but we won't be raptured before the dead in Christ are raptured. It means they'll go first and we'll come right after. So this is saying, the Lord will give salvation to the tents of Judah first. I have a really nice chart. I'm showing you graphs around here, but I can't visualize that with you. But let me just say, the time of Jacob's trouble, the tribulation period. We talked about this when we studied Revelation, but there's two purposes, really three purposes, but two main purposes for the tribulation period. And what the first purpose of the tribulation period is to return the remnant of the Jews back to the faith in the Lord. That's why it's called the time of Jacob's trouble. The second thing it's there for is to judge the unbelievers. Those that will not believe will be judged. Now, along the way, many unbelievers become Christians. They become believers. They're not part of the church. They're part of the tribulation saints. So this is a massive time of a great awakening in the world because of the trouble and because of the witnesses that are there, the 144,000 and all that. But the primary purpose for this is to bring the house of Israel back to the Lord. And we know the house of Israel will be probably less than a third of what it is today. We understand that from both Revelation, and we'll see that here in a
Yeah,
minute as
Jim,
well.
it's so important that we look at the United States and support Israel. And we will continue to be successful. And when, as this diminishes in the United States, we will lose our power.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about why we're not listed in the end times, why the US is not listed in the end times. A lot of people have a lot of theories, and you can, if you read five commentators, you'll get probably 10 opinions. And that's just the way it is. I personally think, and I think I've said this before, when the rapture happens, and I don't know how many Christians are actually in the United States. So we've got 330 million people. And I'd say probably if you looked at church rolls or asked people to self-identify, there's probably 100 or 120 or 30 million Christians. Out of that, I don't know how many are what we would call real Christians and how many are social Christians. But let's say there's 50 million real Christians. When the rapture happens, 50 million people will be gone. And these people, we joke about this. The Congress won't be affected very much. Some other places won't be affected. But the heartland of this country, the military, the people that make it work, the people that own the businesses all over the country will be gone. What do you do? How do you operate? And I think that's the thing that really changes us from a world-class power to kind of one of the groups of people. I don't think Europe's going to be much affected. China's not going to be, although China's got a pretty big church right now, but in aggregate, China's going to be there. So I think that's one of the reasons. That's my personal opinion. I'm not, that's not, I won't be dogmatic about that, but I think that's my personal opinion.
Now, maybe you ever thought about Christian airline pilots, flying airlines, and all of a sudden the pilot's taken.
Yeah. Well, if you ever read the books Left Behind series, that's exactly what happens.
No pilots take over, though.
Yeah.
They might be young also.
When it says, and the Lord will give salvation to that, like he's taking the scales out of his eye, their eyes, and they can see.
He is, and that's in the tribulation period. That's when they will be able to see what's happening. We live in, as bad as we think it is now, we live in what's called the wrath of man, the time of the wrath of man. We haven't seen anything like the wrath of God. The wrath of God starts in the tribulation period, and it just progressively gets worse from the first to the middle to the end. And they will begin to see, especially when the 144,000 Jewish evangelists begin to show up and tell them why this is happening. You'll see a massive shift. Now, there's only 16 million Jews in the world today. And I don't know how many will be in that time, but let's just say the Bible tells us about 30% of them will be in the remnant. So what's that? About 4,500 Jews will be the ones that will be converted. I hate to reduce that to numbers because it sounds like so many are going to die, but so many will, as well as other people. So I'm getting off track here, but yeah, thank you for your question. Did I answer it? Okay. Never know. I follow too many rabbit trails sometimes. I'm off down the path. So it says, let me see, where did I leave off? In verse 6, and the Lord will give salvation to the tents of Judah, and the glory of the house of David, and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem may not suppress that of Judah. So we're talking about now this time when they all begin to come back to the Lord, especially Judah, because Judah is where most of the Jews that are remaining come from. Now the Lord knows where the other 10 tribes are, wherever they're scattered. But the tribe of Judah is the one that's gathered pretty much Judah and Benjamin in the land of Israel today. So that's kind of an interesting little sidelight here. On that day, the Lord will protect the inhabitants of Jerusalem. We see that today, so that the feeblest among them on that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, and the angels like the angel of the Lord going before them. And on that day, I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. If you read any of the prophetic literature and you understand what happens at the end of the prophetic time, you see that, I mean, picture David, a young boy with a slingshot takes down the giant, you know, and routs the Philistines. The weakest one in Jerusalem will have that kind of power. The others in Jerusalem, the armies and others, will be like they're on fire from God. And it says the angel of the Lord, and we know the angel of the Lord, when it's mentioned that way, who is that? That's Christ. That's the pre-incarnate Christ. So the pre-incarnate Christ will be here. Now, we know that because we know the second coming comes. And when he comes, all these people gathered, he doesn't, you know, get in a tank and ride over the border. He just speaks and they're done. He just speaks and it's over. And he says, I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. So again, this is a very shorthand view of what we see when we look at, you know, a number of the verses, a number of the biblical books, but especially Revelation. And then in verse 10, we begin to see a little bit about, this is where we should have started today. So I'm kind of taking a lot of time, but I'll get caught up. Verse 10, and I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me, on whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only child and weep bitterly over him as one weeps over a firstborn. We'll talk about that. On that day, the mourning in Jerusalem will be great as the mourning in Hadad Rimon in the plain of Megiddo. Now, let me stop there for a minute. We're talking about the tribulation time here. We're talking about the God will send a spirit of grace. We know this. We know that even though we're raptured out and the spirit within us is raptured out, the spirit is not gone. The spirit is in the earth at that time. Otherwise, no one could come to the Lord because that comes through the Holy Spirit. So the spirit is active. And when these evangelists come, the two witnesses and the 144,000 evangelists, there's going to be a revival like we haven't seen before. And it says they a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy. So I'm sure these prophets are going to be pleading for mercy for the people that come because, you know, remember the judgment is beginning to rain down. And they will weep bitterly when they recognize that the Messiah was really Jesus of Nazareth, who they had a hand in crucifying. When that happens, they will be pierced to the heart. And whether that happens before they see him come on the white horse or whether it happens at that time, certainly it'll happen when they see him come on the white horse. But it may happen before because of the words of the prophets and these are the two witnesses and the 744,000 little Billy Grahams, as I call them, Jewish Billy Grahams. And he says, on that day, I'll seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Well, we know that that's a massive destruction for all these forces that are gathered from all the nations of the earth, but especially those ones that we encounter in the Gog and Magog war and all of that stuff that they, you know, from Russia and Iran and Libya and Sudan and all the countries that are listed in Genesis 10 that we see part of that in that table of nations. It says, I'll pour out on the house of David's spirit of grace. Now, remember in the book of Joel, is an interesting book. It's only three chapters long. But one of the primary functions of that is to talk about a time in the future when God's spirit will again come and pour out on the people. And so we're seeing this prophecy in Joel fulfilled. We saw it at Pentecost. We're going to see it further fulfilled in this time. And in the New Testament, they talk about this prophet Joel and the fact that this was an early fulfillment of what would be an ultimate fulfillment of God's spirit being poured out. So I'm hoping you're seeing here in Zechariah a partial fulfillment of what are long-term prophecies. And we're seeing them in our day. We're seeing the seeds of them and the roots of them as they come to fruition in our day. Hadad Rimon, by the way, nobody knows who that is or what it is. A lot of people comment on the morning for Hadad Rahman in the Plain of Megiddo. We know Megiddo is the place where you can watch the Valley of Jezreel, and you can, that's where the Battle Armageddon is going to be fought and all that. There are some people that think this was a town there that's now been wiped out. There are some commentators that think that. But these are also names that sound like two gods of Assyria. So maybe it's the people who are weeping for their gods of stone and wood that got wiped out. I don't know what it is, but I think obviously to the people who read this, they understood what that mean, even though we don't understand what it means. Either way, it means something happened, something they wanted to worship like a firstborn, and then now they're gone and they weep in a very tragic way. He says, the land shall mourn, each family by itself. I'll just read this, but each family by itself, each clan by itself, each of the women by themselves, and he goes down through a set of clans that he mentions. All of this says, all this weeping will not be, we won't gather at church and have a celebration of life. This will be individual weeping. Families will weep, the wives will weep, the clans will weep. This will be a national mourning of all the people because of what they recognize as the sin of Israel in having the Messiah crucified. Now, I would just say in God's providence, that was part of God's plan. You know, and the church has fallen into a, we've kind of gotten through it now, but the church fell into a really bad place in the early life of the church from, let's say, 100 to 1000 AD, where people thought Jews were the Christ killers, you know, and they went after the Jews. And, you know, a lot of the hate to Jews was by Christians early because of this fact. What's unfortunate is what they didn't understand was this was God's plan. It wasn't that they thwarted God's plan. God used them to fulfill his plan. So just like the Romans were used to fulfill his plan, just like Cyrus was used to fulfill the plan, just like what we're seeing in the U.S. is being used by God to fulfill the plan that he has. All of this, and we can't lay individual blame. You can certainly feel guilty for them and how they felt guilty, but the blame is not with the Jews per se. It's just the fact of who they were, and God used this as a way to have them make visible their hate and make visible their choice and make visible their destruction, because all of that came about by the way they treated him in the land. You know, the high priest is probably not going to be one of the guys that's going to be standing before where Christ, what do they call it? The judgment seat of Christ. They're going to be at the white throne judgment. They're going to be at the end times where they're all punished. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting how all these little pieces, especially if you read the Old Testament, all these little pieces tend to be a giant 10,000 piece puzzle. And every time you read something, another puzzle piece falls in. And what you begin to see after a while is you begin to look at the Old Testament and you see it as a mosaic that presents Christ in picture form through the words, pictures of time, pictures him and what he's going to say. And then the fulfillment of that, the final pieces are placed in the New Testament so that the picture is clear. And I think it's fascinating when you study both Old and New Testaments to see that come about. And now we get to chapter 13, which is what I want to get finished today. So let me get on. These are short chapters, so unless I get too windy here, we should be okay. Let me scroll this up so you can read it. I'm in my Logos software. Like, you can't, I can barely read it, so I know you can't read it, but I can't make this much bigger. Maybe I can make it a little bigger. Let me see if I can do that. Not that it's going to make a huge difference. No, that's as big as I can make it. So verse 13, again, there's, what is there, 11, 12 verses? I can't see that. 11 verses, 12 verses. So we'll get through this fairly quickly, but this is important. On that day, again, on that day, and if you underline on that day in each of these chapters, you're going to find, I don't know, 8 or 10. I got the real number in my notes, but I can't remember what it is. But it's 8 or 10 times that phrase is used. And so you say, well, what is that day? And I think I mentioned before, that day is really a time of future judgment. And it doesn't mean just a day, it means a period of time. So on that day or in that epoch of time, you're going to see these things happen. On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will cut off the names of the idols from the land so that they shall be remembered no more. We're talking about now the tribulation period. We're talking about the judgment that begins on the people. Also, I will remove from the land the prophets and the spirit of uncleanliness. You might ask, well, why is he removing the prophets? Well, let me just say, if you've removed the spirit of uncleanliness and you have removed the idols of worship, the prophets don't have anything to talk about. The need for the prophet has gone away. You look at these prophets and they're all prophesying, most of them, about Israel wandering away from the Lord, you know, being apostate. All of that is now gone at this time. They're all gone. So there's no prophets left in the land. And then he says something interesting. And anyone who again prophesies, his father or mother who bore him will say to him, you shall not live, for you speak the lies in the name of the Lord. And his father or mother who bore him shall pierce him through when he prophesies. Israel is going to take serious the fact that they're in the last days. And people who are speaking prophecies that are not done by the Lord, even in Jewish times, prophets who were not speaking on behalf of the Lord were killed. Even some of the ones speaking on the half of the Lord were killed because the Jews didn't want to hear what they had to say. But this is kind of interesting because it says, not only will I do away with all the godly prophets, but those who are not godly prophets, the people will do away with. They will be purged from the land. It just kind of gives you a sense for the feeling and the passion and what's happening at this particular time. On that day, every prophet will be ashamed of his vision when he prophesies. He will not put on a hairy cloak in order to deceive. You know what that means? Remember John the Baptist? Remember what he wore? Camel's hair, hairy coat. Hairy coat was the sign of a prophet. They wore these coarse, nothing fine. They were people of the land, nothing fine. You know, I picture John the Baptist with crazy hair and wearing, you know, camel hair coats and, you know, sandals and who knows what all. But that's what these prophets kind of looked like. And he's saying they won't bother even to put on that coat because they don't want to be identified as a prophet. And it says, but he will say, I am no prophet. I'm a worker of the soil. And a man sold me in my youth. If one asks him, what are these wounds on your back? He'll say, the wounds I received in the house of my friends. This is strange to us, but you've got to understand two things. One is, if this guy claims to be a prophet and he claims he's not a prophet. So if you go to somebody who's committed a crime and you say, did you commit this crime? No, I'm a humble farmer. This land was given to me by my parents, and I've been working this land for 40 years. Well, prophets also, false prophets, whip themselves to make it look like they were being scourged by the Lord and being told to prophesy. So when the people say, oh, really? Tell me what these wounds are. Well, these are ones I got at my friend's house. These are ones we were horsing around, and we this is kind of a boys will be boys. Let me say it that way. They don't believe this, but this is what they resort to. And you can kind of understand the mentality that says, look, I'm not happy that I felt like I needed to be a prophet. I'm going to just distance myself as far as I can from it. And you're seeing this, we're not seeing it now in the land, but we will see this in the time of the tribulation. Anybody who says, this is not the Lord, this is something else, they're going to be disgraced during that time. And it's going to be a pretty powerful time. Then he comes and he finishes this with a poem, Hebrew poem. We talked about these before and how they're written. They don't rhyme. They are kind of a, it's almost like a cantor where they sing rhymes, sing couplets of verses. The first verse says something, the second verse either augments it or contrasts against it. But they make a real clear point. This one's doing that. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd. This is the Lord talking. Awake, O Lord, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me, declares the Lord of hosts. Well, this is the Lord of hosts talking. Now, who's the man that stands next to the Lord of hosts? Christ. I mean, he's at the right hand of the Lord right now, right? I mean, that's where he is now. And he's talking about a time that we've already seen. He says, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. This is a verse that's quoted a lot. It was quoted in the New Testament. And we understand this. You strike the leader and the sheep scatter. Or another way to say this is cut off the head of a snake. And the snake will just wiggle and it won't have any brain or any direction. So that's kind of a modern euphemism for this. Strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. I'll turn my hand against the little ones in the whole land, declares the Lord. Two-thirds shall be cut off and perish, and one-third shall be left alive. Again, we're seeing here a winnowing of the flock. And again, this is a time, you know, we've talked about the striking of the shepherd when the Lord was crucified. Now we're seeing the result of that as he comes against the Jews who didn't participate, but they're still aiding and abetting that in the way they think and the way they talk and the way they think. I mean, we had an IDF soldier the other day in Lebanon knock down a statue of of Christ and beat the head with a club. Well, Israel's prosecuting him and the one that took the pictures. You know, so Israel today is pretty strong about being open and having multiple faiths there. So if you're a Muslim, if you're a Christian, if you're a Buddhist, whatever you are in Israel, as long as you don't break the law, they're going to leave you alone, and you're going to be able to worship. Which you can't say that for any other country around Israel. And we've seen a little bit of that talked about here. So two-thirds of the people will be cut off, which is means they'll die and perish. And one-third will be left alive. And I will put that third into the fire. I mean, if you don't see the tribulation here, this is what it's talking about. I'll put them in the fire and refine them as one refines silver and test them as gold is tested. So if you've ever refined silver, most of us don't refine silver or gold, but the way you do that is you have a pot and you put the chunks in there and you put fire to it and you heat it up. And when you do that, when the gold gets liquid, the dross, as they call it, the impurities float to the top and they skim those off, and what's left is pure gold. Well, what he's saying is, I'm going to take that third and I'm going to put him in the fire and I'm going to turn the fire up so that all the impurities get purged. They're going to float to the top and we're going to skim them off. And the ones that are left are going to be the ones that are going to be righteous. We can kind of see it is a metaphor, a figure of speech, but it really, in our mind, it tells us exactly the way God is going to do this. And I test them as gold is tested. In other words, he'll test them to see if they're pure. They will call upon my name and I will answer them. Won't it be a great day when what they said on the day going down in Jerusalem, blessed be the name of the Lord, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Won't it be a blessed day when the Jews actually recognize him as the Messiah and come forward and call his name? I mean, that's going to be one of the exciting parts of the tribulation period. Now, we as born again believers will be in the troop that comes down with him. So we'll see it all, but we won't be in the fire. We'll be watching what happens, which is of course a better place to be. Yeah, it'll be in that day. It'll be a great day. And he says, and I will answer them. They'll call my name and I will answer them. You know, God isn't answering a lot of the prayers that are going up if people don't know him and don't come to him. But he will answer that prayer. And I will say, they are my people. So won't it be wonderful, just like God says to us, when we come to him and we say, Lord, forgive me of my sins. I want to come to you. I want to trust what you did. Accept me. I accept you. You know, be with me forever. And he basically says, you are one of my people. He doesn't say it. We don't hear it audibly. But we know that once we've done that, the Bible tells us we are God's children now. We're one of his people. But he'll say to them, you are one of my people. And they will say, the Lord is my God. I mean, so this kind of cuts off. I don't want to start 14 because I want to finish next week and do a summary with hopefully some real charts. We'll finish this. But 13, 12, 11, 12, and 13 are important verses, chapters, because what they do is they lay out at a very high level what's going to happen in the end times. And, you know, you can read Revelation for all the, you know, all the bowls and trumpets and, you know, seals and all that stuff. And again, don't get caught up in all the imagery. Just understand the essence of what happens. And we see it here. He's going to punish. There's going to be a refined fire. It's 2/3 are going to go. 1/3 is going to be refired. Refined. We see that in the trumpet and the trumpet and the what's the first one?
Seals.
The seal, yes, thank you. The seal judgments, you see that because, you know, 1/3 of the world is killed here, 1/3 of the waters, 1/3 of this. The next one, it's half. So by the end of but you get through the first two, you're down to about 1/3 of the people left. And that's kind of where we are now. He bypasses all that. But when you read Revelation or you read the New Testament, you see where where Peter and where all the prophets, the New Testament apostles, understood what he meant. Yeah, Lynn.
Interesting, Jim, to think even the third will have to be purified.
Well, the third aren't believers. But it's the other thing that's interesting is how do the thirds get selected? And I would submit to you the third gets selected because they begin to see the Lord. They begin to identify that he's the one that has done this. And when the witnesses come, they begin to move. And when the Spirit begins to move, once the Spirit is moved in a person, he will carry them through and God will take them where they're ultimately going to be. So I think there's probably a lot of discussion we could have about that, but I'm almost on time. Any questions?
Yeah.
Any thought? I'm sorry for not having my charts because this would have been much. It would have been much better if I could have shown you a few pictures along the way. No, I don't either. I'm nervous as I can be.
I'm just curious where it says they mourn for the one they pierced, and I can't read that, so something like that. That's Zechariah, right?
That's Zechariah.
So, what comes first, Zechariah or Isaiah? Do you know? And.
Zechariah. I think Zechariah is first, right? Isaiah's later. I can go back. I don't have my charts to go back and look. Yeah, chronologically, I'd have to look. Zechariah is about 500 BC, 525.
487.
487. So Isaiah comes afterwards, right?
In my chronological Bible, Isaiah comes first.
It's all of Isaiah?
It's roughly the same.
All okay. of Isaiah comes first. It's God, but...
Okay. So I'll have to look that up. I don't know exactly. I mean, they're not very far apart, you know, because they're all back in that general time. Yeah, Scott.
Messianic prophecy.
Yeah, all of this is messianic prophecy. From about 11 on is messianic prophecy. Scott, you had
Well, when Jesus comes to the Mount of Olives, he'll be covered with blood. We see the scriptures talking about that slaying the wicked. He'll have the nail marks in his hands. So many take verse 6 and combine it with verse 7 that the Jews who didn't take the mark of the beast, who still survive, will see those marks. And they'll go, the Messiah.
Yeah, now I understand.
You were him.
Yeah.
And then we have the weeping and the, you know, so on.
So I think that's a great point because he's not going to be different when he comes back. And of course, he's going to come to the Mount of Olives.
He's the Lamb who has been. Here's right. The Lamb who has been slain.
Right, and so that's You know, that's another
They're
way
going
to,
to go, whoa.
it's another little piece of the puzzle that fits in. Carol, you wanted to say, Carol's got a McChaney, what's McChaney's first name?
His name was Robert Murray McShane.
McChaney,
He
okay.
was the pastor of a church in Scotland, I believe in Dundee, if that's in Scotland, in 1842. And he devised this Bible reading plan that takes you through the Bible in a year. You can start on any day. And it also takes you through the Psalms and New Testament twice
Okay.
in the same year.
And you've got guides for those that you're willing to give
Yeah,
people
I've
if you
got
want
it.
if
I
they
ordered a
want
bunch of them.
them. Yeah, you looked it up, didn't
I
you?
did. So Isaiah was written 740 to 680 BC, and Zechariah was written 520 to 480 BC.
Right. So
Zechariah.
Zechariah is probably first. Is that right? 525. When did you say
He's
Isaiah was?
later than Isaiah.
Yeah. Isaiah is 740 to 680
Oh, so it's
BC.
earlier.
It's earlier.
Yeah. So
Zechariah is about
Isaiah is
520.
earlier. Isaiah is earlier. So Isaiah 53 was a was you know something that was known to them as they wrote.
As he gets
Yeah, but
closer to Christ coming, the dates
get smaller.
smaller.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to remember.
Yeah. Without my notes, I don't remember all of
Yeah.
everything. Any other questions or comments? It's exciting. Oh,
Exciting.
listen, I appreciate you all today. I'm sorry I didn't.
It's good.
I thought you
You're
did a good
good.
job.
Yeah, my
Good.
oh, don't do that. Don't do that. My notes are on my computer at home, and I'll look with shame when I go home to find them on my server and not on my laptop. But I won't make that mistake next week, I can assure you. I can assure you. But yeah, you had a question. My timing is better without, well, it's all random without my notes. My notes kind of keep me on a straight path. Well, I know the choir's got to leave, so I'll let you guys do that. Well, let's have a quick prayer and then we'll all dismiss. Lord, it's been a blessing to be in your house today. It's been a blessing to look at your word and study the fact that, Lord, you gave this prophet Zechariah so much insight into what your history would prove to be true later in than his lifetime. Lord, we're thankful to be able to read it, thankful to be able to see it and put the puzzle pieces together to begin to piece together the whole cloth of your word. Lord, I pray for the pastor. I pray for the sermon that he's got. I pray for it to meet the very need that we have in our lives and that it comes to our very heart. And we're just thankful and blessed to be here today. Thank you for all those online. And I pray for them and their families and all those interesting prayer requests that we will have for all the troubles that we're having in the class, all the illness and sickness and recovery. We thank you for those that are here. We pray it in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you all.
Thank you.